If when you think of France, you only think of Paris, you're really shortchanging yourself. Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today I'm going between the lines of The Discovery of France by award-winning author Graham Robb. Robb's work in French literature and history includes biographies of greats like Balzac and Victor Hugo, each selected by New York Times as one of the best books of the year. Thank you so much, Graham, for joining us today and allowing us to go between the lines with you.
Thank you, Valerie. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, according to your new book, long after the advent of the railway and newspapers, France was still very much a land of tribal divisions and pre-Christian beliefs. Now, I've read several books on France and feel rather familiar with it, having spent my honeymoon in Paris, and my husband's family lived in Toulouse. As a matter of fact, my husband and I were remarried in Toulouse, and I thought that I had a familiarity, but your book has given me a whole different perspective. Our train ride down from Paris to Toulouse showed me little of what you talk about. And so I'd like for you to bring us to the point of how you came to take a 14,000-mile trek on bicycle across France to write this book. Why a bicycle?
Well, my wife's American. She comes from Nashville. And as soon as we moved to Europe, we decided not to drive anymore and to cycle. And probably the best country in the world to cycle in is France, because I think there's a general feeling there that that's how you ought to see the country. So that was how we came to do 14,000 miles. We didn't do it all in one go,
right.
Needless to say.
Several years, right?
Yeah, it was over about a 10-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we read guidebooks and we read histories, but I realized that seeing the country at that level and stopping and talking to people, I realized I wasn't really acquiring any deep understanding of what we were actually seeing and why all these little regions were so distinctive and why they changed so quickly from one region to the next. So I didn't really decide to write this history until much later. It was just from trying to collect more information and trying to make the holiday more interesting.
Oh. Well, then you certainly did, because once you started researching it and doing your own bicycle riding, you really were able to get right into the communities and to really feel what that energy level was and to learn their customs. I was fascinated by your section on the tribes of France, the early tribes of France. Let's talk about them for a minute, because I think most of us have the assumption that I did when I normally think of France, is that this was a well-established country for many years that was very cohesive, and the French were very sophisticated, and they all, you know, set the standard,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Yet. Then I read your book. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the tribes.
Yeah, well, that's the organization of France, if you can call it organization, was really tribal, and it's much more like Afghanistan today. But we're talking about a relatively recent period, I mean, up to the end of the 19th century and even early 20th century. And the reason is that most people didn't move very far from home. Probably about radius of 5-10 miles was the average. And it's partly because of geography. You know, if you live in the mountains, obviously it's hard to travel very far. But it's also because of the stability of these regions, and certain populations or subpopulations can be traced way back to even before the Romans. So it's probably not surprising that, you know, when you look at the terrain of France, which is quite extreme, that people were isolated in these tribal groups. And I think once you have a tribal group that's established with its own traditions and especially its own language or its own dialect, it becomes hard for people to move out and interpenetrate in other groups. But it is surprising how long that lasted in France. And as you say, we do think of France as being a fairly sophisticated country, and we don't think of France as being a recent country. but in fact it is.
The young congregations that grew up, they were called Payee. Is that correct? Was that the name for the town, Payee?
That's right,
I found it fascinating about the local rivalries. Tell us about some of the things that they would do to maintain their own Turk area, if you will. You know, the villagers had vulgar names, and just talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, we all know about the Battle of Waterloo and other famous battles in French history, but there were battles and wars being fought all the time between these village groups. And some of them were quite violent. And when you look at the criminal records and court records, you don't always find a trace of this, because these were regions that weren't policed at all, that had their own systems of justice and that didn't keep written records. And again, we're talking about a fairly recent period, up to the 19th century. And, you know, they behave pretty much the way that nation states behave today. They are characterized by a certain belligerence. They knew how to defend their national pride, if that's what you can call it. And
they're quite hostile to government, though. These traditionally, they were very hostile to the government. But yet, if you're a stranger, they might be friendly to you.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's a bit like today that there is still a great suspicion about the people in Paris, and that's still the big division in France between Paris and the provinces, much more than between the city and the country. And in fact, even today, if you go almost anywhere in France, I'm sure you found this, that people are very welcoming, very friendly, will go out of their way to help you. But if there is one group that tends to be treated with suspicion or reluctance, it does tend to be Parisians. And in fact, when I first went over there with my wife, she had to obtain her stay visa in Paris, and for various reasons we weren't able to do that. We had to wait until we got to a little town in the depths of the provinces. At the town hall they said, oh, you should have obtained it in Paris, you know. And we said, oh, Paris, it was so difficult. And they said, oh, we understand, that's okay.
Come on, I'll take care of you. Those Parisians, you know.
That's right.
What are they, you know, what are they good for? You know, those little hamlets were fascinating, too, when you talked about them. There's one hamlet in particular that, well, there might have been many, that practiced human hibernation. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, in the Alps in particular, in the high Alps, which were covered in snow most of the year, it made sense to just close down altogether, pack yourself into bed with the rest of the family, and move as little as possible. It was really just a way of surviving. So in some parts, people would stay in bed for 6 or 7 months.
And that's literally, maybe to get up to go to the bathroom or something. But
exactly,
yeah.
It's just, you know, you reduce your metabolic rate so that you don't exhaust your meager food supplies.
Right.
And if someone died during that period of hibernation, they would put the body on the roof where it would be preserved by ice and snow until the ground had thawed and a priest could reach the village. But the surprising thing in France is that people also hibernated in warmer parts, in wine-growing parts. And it seems to have been a normal part of life at the time. People weren't interested in economic gain. They were just interested in staying alive. And of course, that's died out now, I should add. I mean, we still talk about sleepy villages, but they're awake.
Yeah. Let's talk about racism, though, which is not asleep in France and has not been for a long time. France has a history, according to your book, of racism and discrimination, especially of rural cultures, the undesirables or the cursed races. Tell us about the Cagots. I was very interested in that.
Well, I was amazed to find out about this caste, really, called the Cagots, because they're not mentioned in any histories of France. They were a group of people who were treated as pariahs, outcasts, who were only allowed to go into church through a certain small door, and you can still see a lot of these churches, were only allowed to take water from a special font. They weren't allowed to walk barefoot in public. They were forced to live in certain parts of the town or village, usually the swampy part on the edge of town. And the really curious thing about them is that no one knows where this group came from or even if they came from anywhere and why they were persecuted. And even though some people have said they were descendants of lepers who came back from the Crusades in the Middle Ages, or they were the descendants of Saracen invaders who'd come from North African Spain.
Yes, yeah, Saracens being like the Moors or dark, short people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Arabs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But there was apparently no distinguishing features at all. And the only thing that set them off from everyone else was that certain family names were thought to be cagoules. And there were long rhyming poems that preserved these names so that from generation to generation, everyone knew who these people were. And it's almost as if, with a population that seems to have been quite settled and just existed for centuries in the same place, even in those conditions, there had to be a separate group to be persecuted.
Mm, mm, mm. They paid no taxes because they were considered unclean, and so they didn't want the dirty money
from them.
Yeah.
I think that was the only benefit.
Well, and plus they were excused from military service because they weren't allowed to have guns.
That's right.
So that, yeah. This sounds very familiar to some of the other racism that we see around the world. Mm. One thing that you mentioned in the book was that they were very, very adaptable. And maybe that was one of the reasons why they've survived, too, because they were able to go into a community and, like you say, pick up the dialect and, you know, just kind of work with whatever that group was.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's talk about fairies, virgins, and saints. You had a chapter with a similar title. And in that, I'm going to quote you where you said, "The social and political development of France owes a great deal to these supernatural acts of inanimate objects." Why did you say that?
Well, one of the things that, well, I'm not sure if my wife would agree that it was much fun because they're very hard to find on the map, but the prehistoric stones that you find in certain parts of France, sometimes forming little tables called dolmens or just standing stones called menhirs. It turns out these were, even though they were put there in prehistoric times, they remained objects of religious devotion. They're like very primitive churches.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, people would go and whisper to the magic stone in the way that they would go and get advice from a priest. And, you know, they believed that these stones had certain powers, and that even though the saints of the Catholic Church also had certain powers, they were relatively new, and you couldn't really trust them as much.
The saints were new, huh? The saints were new.
The saints were new.
Couldn't be trusted by the natives. Huh?
And the Catholic Church knew this, and they knew that even though the Romans had stamped out Druidism and Gaul or France had been Christianized about 14 centuries before, they knew that the work of converting the pagan population to Christianity still wasn't complete, even in the early 20th century, because of these pagan practices. And in fact, they're still going on today. I met someone recently who lives in a small village in Normandy, and she said she has a friend in the village who went to the doctor recently. He said, "You're going to have an operation." And she said, "Okay, well, I'm just..." And she got a cell phone and phoned up the local witch to ask if she agreed with the doctor's diagnosis.
Well, if you've just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going Between the Lines with Graham Robb, who's written a fascinating, well, it's a guide/history to early France. The book is called The Discovery of France, A Historical Geography from the Revolution to the First World War. And indeed, I have learned so much more that I didn't know about France. Why was there such an abundance, though, of saints? Because as I read on, you know, saints started replacing, you know, some of the pagan gods. But what was it about saints that made them so important?
Well, saints were important because it meant you could have your own local saint. And what happened in many parts of France is that, for example, if you had a swamp or a pond nearby that was thought to be sacred, the name of the pond, which Anna was a Gaulish word for pond, would become the name of the saint. So a lot of the parts of Brittany, in particular in northwestern France, where there's a Saint Anne or a church dedicated to Saint Anne, was actually originally a swamp, and the church just took the name and gave it to the saint. Mm. And these saints weren't considered to have anything to do with Rome or the Bible or Christianity. They were purely local saints, and people would say, the old statue of the Virgin in the church has to be replaced because it's rotting away. And when they tried to do that and bring in a new one, there'd be violent protests because the saint or the Virgin was considered to be the object itself. And if you took that away, you're taking away its powers as well.
Mm-hmm. And saints were thought to be more powerful in a way than God, right? Because they were in this material world, and so were presumed to be more helpful, right?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, God was seen as a very distant figure. He probably came from Paris. He was some kind of official being who didn't really do much. And there were no stories about God. And so there was this huge confusion, and Jesus Christ and St. Peter were generally thought to be quite canny and cunning. And St. Peter was the simpleton, and Jesus was the one who knew how to do things. You know, he may not know how to work miracles, but he'd say to St. Peter, you know, when you're selling your horse at the fair, don't tell people about its faults. Otherwise, you'll never be able to sell it. So Jesus was full of useful wisdom. And there was very little connection with the Bible.
Well, I see. But Virgin Mary, though, was even more important than God or Jesus, right? Because she was more sympathetic. She was quite popular.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blacksmiths played a crucial role, right?
Yeah, they did. They were faith healers as well as blacksmiths. And one very common remedy for pains associated with pregnancy consisted of the woman lying down on the anvil, and the blacksmith would heat up his forge and hammer the anvil while the woman was lying on it.
Hmm.
And this was thought to make childbearing less painful as well. And, that was a very popular remedy.
Well,
I think blacksmiths, you know, if you see a blacksmith's forge, it does look magical and sparks flying about.
Right. But the blacksmith in that community would be like the doctor and the magician and the blacksmith all rolled into one. He was quite a guy, huh?
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the languages, the early on languages, because one of the most shocking and surprising things in the book to me was that in 1800, only 11% of France's population spoke French.
Yeah, that's right.
So what were they speaking then, if they weren't speaking French?
Well, they were speaking a variety of languages which are quite distinct. In Brittany, they spoke Breton, which is a Celtic language. And in fact, people from Brittany who went across the Channel and went to Wales could make themselves understood better than they could if they traveled to other parts of France. Basque, which is an entirely separate language group, was spoken in the southwest. And then the whole south of what we now call France spoke a different group of languages called Occitan. And
I tried to look that word up and I couldn't find it. What is Occitan?
It comes from the word in those languages for yes, which was Oc. And so that was called the land of Oc. And the northern part of France was called the land of Oui, like the modern French Oui for yes. So, and they didn't, you know, when the revolution came along, they didn't realize that there was such a diversity of languages in France, and they realized they were sending out their new decrees, which mm-hmm. people were supposed to be able to understand, and they realized that people couldn't understand them. And it was only then that they realized that there were so few French speakers in the French Republic.
And when we say there were hundreds of dialects, we mean serious dialects, because there was even, or there, I don't know if there is today, but the book indicates that there was a whistling language.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell us about that.
Well, that was used by shepherds in the Pyrenees to talk to one another, because it was quite a lonely job, of course, just standing out in the fields tending your flocks. So there was this ear-splitting whistling language which could travel across the mountains. And it wasn't, it sounds as though it must have been a primitive signaling language, but actually apparently someone, one of the last whistlers of it, could transmit the contents of the local newspaper in whistles. And it was last used, it seems to have died out quite recently. There are still people alive who remember hearing it, but it died out shortly after the Second World War. And its last well-known use was to help paratroopers escape over the Pyrenees when they'd been parachuted into France during the Second World War.
All right, so we had all of these languages, hundreds and hundreds of dialects. So, well, they started to do that, to unify the language. They enforced it in the schools, and poor kids were punished if they didn't speak the proper French. And tell us about that experiment. Was it successful?
It was, I think, like most attempts to interfere with what people consider their natural way of life, it was not very successful. But it was once people realized that it was to their benefit to speak French that it started to succeed. And the interesting thing about that is that at the time of the revolution, the Abbé Grégoire himself didn't want people to be punished because they didn't speak French. That came much later in what we could call modern France, the end of the 19th century. And even the early 20th century, when school teachers were instructed to punish pupils who used Breton or Basque or Alsatian in school. And that's when it became very, very punitive.
And not very thorough, because they were force-feeding the French to the kids, but yet the kids would still go home and speak their patois or whatever and then forget it when they leave school, like we did the Latin and French that we learned in school.
Yeah, right.
Do you think they were any better than we were in maintaining that knowledge?
Yeah, I think, eventually it just became necessary to speak French. And, of course, some of the children who believed it would go home and see their parents as simpletons and peasants, because they weren't up to date. But people continued to speak their own languages. I think this is a mistake that legislators often make. They think that bilingualism or trilingualism is unusual, whereas it's normal throughout the world. I mean, only being able to speak one language is unusual. You know, there aren't many countries
That's
in
true.
Which people only speak one language. So I think they overestimated the problem. And the funny thing is, the language that they were trying to get people to speak is really an artificial language that was more or less invented by the French Academy from various dialects. And French was just one dialect. And even now in France, people would say, no one speaks French properly. No one knows all the rules, and everyone makes grammatical mistakes. So it's really a language that no one speaks.
We started out earlier talking about the racism in early France. Yet there still seems to be a problem today. And the victims are the children of immigrants. Talk to that for a moment, please.
Yeah, there still is a problem. I've seen in today's times that there have been riots again in the suburbs of Paris. And it's the thing that isn't mentioned, because it's not a dramatic event, is that there is a lot of discrimination against non-whites who live in the suburbs of big cities. And this is a feature of French society that seems to have continued. And it's not even the children of immigrants, or it's people who were immigrants many generations ago. And in fact, I have a friend in Oxford who's a historian, very distinguished, Sudhir Hazari Singh, who comes from the island of Mauritius. And he's been all over France doing archival research, but there are certain towns he can't go to because of the way he'd be treated there. And that's really the main reason why these riots are occurring, apart from social deprivation. It's not just attacks on the police. It's the fact that the police will routinely humiliate
and
harass.
Well, it seems that the older France was dominated by two contradictory ideas. One, that the suburban savages, those outside of the city, were dark and stunted and belonged to a very primitive race. I'm taking this from your book. And that, two, they, who were supposed to be the real French, were descendants of Gaul. But you say there's no such thing as a pure French race.
Yeah, that's right. It's all muddled up like most European countries. I mean, France has been at a crossroads of Mediterranean and Northern European civilizations for centuries and centuries, long before the Romans. So it's not surprising that the population is culturally and ethnically very, very mixed. And in fact, the new French president, Sarkozy, is in some ways a typical Frenchman because he's first generation French and his parents came from Hungary.
So the notion of a unified France, there really is no such thing, is there?
There is in, people are certainly aware of belonging to the French Republic, and
right,
there are certain shared aspirations. But on that kind of level, no, it's as diverse as most European countries.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Rob, this has been fascinating. I'm going to go back and reread the book yet again, because there's so much in it. Thank you for such a well-done discovery of France.
Thank you very much, Father. It was nice talking to you.
Graham Robb's book is The Discovery of France, a historical geography from the Revolution to the First World War. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or participate in the online book club. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. Executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor, Mike Johns. Technical producer, Ken Mary. Production assistant, Chichi Morka. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. For information on how to be a funder for Between the Lines, please call 678-686-0390. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.